Hi, good afternoon, world. Wesley Pepper here, and this is my podcast, Mr. Pepper's Art Lexia. Yeah, man, this is episode 11, so I'm really into it. First, you know, man, thanks to all the listeners. You know, having a look at the stats every week, I mean, there's consistent growth through all of the episodes, and that's fantastic, man. And I'm also getting a lot of shout outs on social media. And that's been fantastic too, man. So at least you guys are listening, and that's great, man, because, you know, the idea is to talk art and art-based topics around our industry, but also activism. And today's episode, I'd like to talk about, I'm going to talk to Paul Hendricks from Cape Town, and we're going to be talking about, so he's an activist and a teacher, an art and a school teacher, but you know, he teaches art as well. And I actually got hold of him through a collective in Cape Town called X Collective, and we spoke a bit on Monday, and I got to know him a bit. And so we're going to be talking about just the, I guess, the complexities, man, and the politics around what's happening in the education system. You know, I did an episode with Ntabi a few weeks ago from Skillful Spaces, and that episode did pretty well. It seems people really enjoyed the subject, and it's something I'd like to follow on, because I know many of you are parents, and this is the, you know, how COVID has impacted the education sector is absolutely crazy. So Paul works, you know, we spoke about it on Monday, and he told me a bit about, it's just complicated, man. The whole thing is just absolutely complicated and absolutely crazy. And I don't think anybody in terms of the leadership in the country has any idea what they're doing. And to a degree, I can't really blame them. But on the other hand, I can. I think we should be critical of everything. And we're playing with our the very sensitive subject matter here. I mean, sure, man. A friend of mine was telling me, like, you know, he is basically got to spend about a gigabyte of data per class, and if you add that up, four classes or lessons a day, and if you times it by a week, by a month, it's quite a, it becomes quite an expense. So, you know, well, that's just one aspect, but there are so many. And also, I'd like to also, you know, unpack a bit about the politics that's happening in Cape Town. I know there's so many things there actually that I'd like to look at. So we'll see how the conversation goes. And yeah, man, I'm, you know, in my previous episode, I said I was gonna try to speak about my forthcoming episodes, so I won't say anything up until I confirmed it. But yeah, man, I'm looking also to do some, I've got some really cool things lined up, and some really cool people. And you know, because I just think it's so relative, it's so important to talk about how artists are dealing with this, with a pandemic, man. And there's so many other things I still want to unpack. I think I'm just about hitting the surface here, you know. I'm thinking, because I'm noticing, or I've noticed, you know, how artists have responded, and I think it's quite incredible. I think it's very important to talk about these processes and to document these creative processes and how creators are dealing with this, because I think it's important, and what we're doing now is going to have such a long-lasting effect. And so, yeah, man, plenty of exciting things to come. And yeah, I'm just can't wait, man. I'm thinking of adding on a few new things in the future, but you know, for now I'm just gonna run with the same system, so, or the same formula I've been using. So once again, man, thanks for tuning in, and thank you for listening, and thank you for all the comments and everything, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. So during I introduced you as a activist and a school teacher, man. So for my listeners, give me a bit of a background on
your teaching, the art education, and a bit of activism. So you know who, you take the lead there.
Well, thanks, Wesley, for this interview.
Batman.
It's not often that I get to speak about myself, and I think that is something that is feeling new to me.
Okay, well, go for it. Yes,
are you playing more underground? So the thing here is that I come out of the 1980s.
Yeah.
Same as a student at primary school through the 76 period, 1980, and of course by high school, my high school years, 1985 was a moment for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was a time when I went into study art at higher education level at the university at Michaelis. It was shaped by the events of 1985.
Okay.
School boy end of the year, because they were either forced to by, you know, the fact that the exams went ahead and they had to give up the year, or they had to then maybe find another way, you know, become unemployed, go back to school. So it was very uncertain times, and it was a very divided time as well. I was at that time at the university at Michaelis, my first year.
Yeah.
And that shaped a lot of my thinking at the time. But I also want to point out that before that, when I was at Livingston High, we had many teachers that shaped our consciousness.
Yeah.
I was one of the students. I was in an art class at the time. And though I was in the art class, many other teachers outside of art had a great impact on my thinking. And I just want to point out, for instance, that I was really involved in sport. So my phys ed teacher, Mr. Birch at the time, used to speak to us regularly about what was happening on the sports front. And one of the things that stood out for me very strongly was when he said to us one day, you know, with this apartheid, they allow, you know, you're not allowed to go to the beaches because it's white only beaches. Like you were not supposed to go to many other places as people of color. He said, well, they allowed to, and I think that hit home quite powerfully for me at the time. I think I was in grade 8 or standard 6 at the time. Grade 8 today. Who confirmed a lot of that for me. And you know, Livingston High was also a stronghold of the unity movement. If people know that politics, and the teachers, though they were not identified or easily identifiable as people who belong to the unity movement, because they operated mostly in secret. There was an inkling that there were these teachers who were politicos, and we had a vice principal at the time, Otto Dudley, who used to speak, I think, almost underhand way, but he was also very knowledgeable on many other things, and so we took in some of that, but we also rebelled against it. So though it was seen as a unity movement school, there were many students who were more ANC inclined. And I probably was one of them at the time. So when I came to university, I was really in a sense primed. So student activism was a big part of the moment when it all exploded, in a sense. And from there, of course, it affected influenced my art making. And I recall very clearly that I went into a discipline at that time where options between painting, sculpture, ceramics, printmaking, and so forth. And I went into printmaking.
Oh, interesting.
And so printmaking became a very interesting medium for me, because there, you know, we were exposed to a lot of what was then called township art. It's still today called that, in a sense. And some of the some of my influences came particularly from the Community Arts Project, because when I got to Michaelis, I realized that I was a bit behind in terms of things like life drawing. I had never been exposed to a nude model before. And drawing was a big part of the Michaelis setup. So I went to community arts project in Woodstock at the time, where I was fortunate enough to be exposed to people like Cecil Scotness.
And
many other artists then who also attended classes, life drawing classes. I think Zapiro was one of them. And there was a range of other arts people. And so that sort of was a ferment that allowed for debate. Lionel Davis was there as well. And, you know, quite a few other artists. But nonetheless, the point is that that fed into my artwork further. By the time I came to second, third year, I was producing more overtly what I used to talk about, what I used to think about as working class art. I used to travel a lot by public transport, of course, late at night when I came from art school. And I used to do a lot of my drawings happen on the train.
Okay.
Looking at people coming from work, you know, looking at the type of work they did. You know, on the third class carriage is a huge amount of subject matter there. So I got to draw some of that with a little pad I used to carry around with me. And I used to convert it into some of my printmaking work, you know, at Michaelis, and later also at CAP itself. So that was my early years. And then I continued at Community Arts Project into the 90s, as a matter of fact, when I was when I started teaching. And people who were very influential then was a artist by the name of Mario Sickle. And very few people know of Mario, but he's one of the par excellence wood sculptors that, that in a sense has been hidden from the art world. And I recall I started, we were doing drawing with him, and later on went into sculpture, some wood sculpture as well. And used to go out onto the Cape Flats, as a matter of fact, and collect wood. Trees that were either burnt or had been chopped down and so forth. And that was about 1990, early 1990s. And that, in a sense, exposed me to a lot of other media and the joys of other media that I hadn't been exposed to at Michaelis. As a matter of fact, the Community Arts Project was one of those places where I really learned art. Michaelis was, in a sense, a certification process that happened. You had to go through it in order to become a teacher, to become a known artist, maybe. Anyway, those are my early years. And then from there, I went, of course, into taking that further with students, you know, and exposing them to some of those ideas. But I don't want to go on too much about that. You have other questions that you want to take from there.
Yeah, man. Like you said some really interesting things there. Firstly, the thing of township art, like I find that as a subject matter. Like I actually like to debate that. Maybe not today, but like I find that thing as a whole to debate that thing, because I find like Black expression was just shoved into a corner, and anything that was that some form of resistance was just called township art. And I find actually that as a whole term is quite derogatory, because you have other movements like Forfism, Cubism, all these other things. But then, like, you know, something that is deep rooted in pain and in capitalism was just, anyway, that's another topic for another day. Interesting thing about printmaking as well. Just quickly, what medium did you use? Was it lino cut, etching, dry point?
It started at Michaelis essentially with lino cutting. I had been exposed to a little bit of that when I was at high school at Livingston. I did art there under Mr. Esterhazen. And we were introduced to a bit of lino cutting there. But when I got to university, of course, I was very much on my own. And so I could explore further. So lino cutting, some woodblock printing, of course, as well. Then etching, dry point, of course, aquatint, and various other techniques. But what really caught me eventually was lithography, stone lithography. Well, a big part of that was because, you know, as a student at the time, financially, one was in a bit of a corner. Stone lithography was actually a medium that allowed me to keep my budget under control and still be able to produce work.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
spoke to what I was trying to do at the time, you know.
Yeah, it's actually quite a, I've worked in that as well. It's a very, very interesting. Yeah, you say it's low cost as well. And this was in the early 80s now. So I want to get into the, late 80s. Sorry. But I want to get into the, teaching thing, man. Cause like, like me as an, I'm an artist too. Like I use my art as a form of activism and why, I always try to, I always look at society and I try to communicate it as a whole, but I'm speaking from a force for a certain base. Anyway, let me not get in too much in that. But like, if you're coming from such a creative, background, living up in those times, I was still a small snotgat lady during the 80s, so I don't remember it, but I've read up extensively. And I know some activists who did some stuff in Cape Town around that time, especially with that 1985 resistance that you were talking about earlier on. So I'm not really interested, man. So if you look at how kids growing up back then in the 80s, the adversity they dealt with. I mean, like if you fast forward to 2020, I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. I mean, COVID has came in and changed everything, man. And like the stress that that the youth felt during the 80s and the 70s, I think is absolutely nothing compared to what these like kids are going through now, man. And like, it's like even here where I'm now, I see them walking in the streets, like just got nothing else to do. So from that thing, man, like we were 140 odd days now into the lockdown thingy. Sure, it almost feels like a whole year. From where you're teaching from, or from your school, how are these kids dealing with COVID, man? And are they accessing any, or do they have access to any tools that enhances let me just give you a background, because with creativity, with art, if you are very interactive with art, then your problem solving skills is a bit more than somebody else who just does everything boof, 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 boof. So from your experience, do these kids have that? Are they able to tap into that, or are they just absorbing all the stress? Or yeah, man, like how is that? How do you see that?
Yeah, you know, there's a few approaches I could come in when answering that question, but let me be more direct about it.
Yeah,
the students at the moment are very uncertain about things from what I can gather. That is, at the school I'm at South Peninsula High, some of them are anxious. They obviously know that it's an important time in their lives, that they're facing a final examination that will probably decide the opportunities.
Yeah, pretty much the future, yeah.
Yeah, so, and you know, kids who come from working class communities, they don't always get opportunities.
For sure.
So they must make use of the opportunities they do get.
For sure.
So that puts a bit of more pressure on them than it would maybe a middle class child or a child that comes from an affluent background.
Mm.
Okay, where they may get another shot at it, another bite at the apple. So I think in that respect, you know, we're trying to also be mindful of how children are responding in this period. And some of them are responding in ways that are anxious because they stay away from school. Their parents feel that maybe they're vulnerable, or the grandparents, their parents are vulnerable, that is the children's parents, because some of the children also live with the grandparents. As you know, you know, our families, you know, in the townships, many of them stay together.
Yeah,
and so you know, children going to school and then coming back home means they exposed whatever they picked up at school to the older people. So as a result, it's pressure on the students, and they're very mindful of the fact that they could be carrying the virus back home with them.
Sure.
So the attendance is erratic, but parents, you see, parents are caught. They either not send their child to school and then forfeit the year, or forfeit some of that education and hope for the best at the end of the year. or they send them to school and try and be as cautious as possible. And I think that, you know, has different repercussions for kids, because some kids can handle that in some way or the other. Others cannot handle it that well. And so the concentration levels in class vary. They respond erratically. You know, some are more temperamental. I mean, people are people. They have different, you know, emotional kind of abilities to cope with stresses and strains that come with this period. So all in all, it is tough. It's tough on the teachers. It's tough on the kids. And obviously, it's tough on parents as well. But one has got to also understand that this is not just now one school I'm talking about. I'm also part of a bigger group called the Progressive Organizations Formation.
Okay.
And they consist of communities, organizations that have an activist background. So there are unions in there. There are community structures or community bodies. Some schools here and there. Very few teachers, strangely enough.
Okay,
that's interesting. This says a lot.
Yeah, it does.
That says a lot. And the reason for that is because teachers are under pressure at the moment to deliver. The department, in a sense, education department, holds many of the trump cards. They actually, you know, can dictate to principals largely, who in turn dictate to teachers. And because the unions are not strong at the moment, well, the unions are not strong. They are able to manipulate the situation, the department. And so if they put enough pressure on the principals, the principals will obviously pull the teachers in line. And they will, they'll use different methods of making sure that they are at the school. And as a result, we do not get teachers coming out to protest openly, to be part of the resistance movement. And it's quite amazing. So even in our working class schools, there's a sense that it's open. We know it's not normal. We know the absentee is high, but they're continuing. And so there's this abnormality, but nonetheless, you know, they try to create the idea that this schooling is going ahead.
Yeah, that's normal.
So the department, the department has continued with their agenda, and basically is to set the exam for the NSCs, the National Senior Certificate.
Yeah.
You know, the timetable's out. The students know when the exams are going to happen, and now they must prepare themselves, and so must teachers prepare the students. So that is the situation we're in, of high abnormality, but you know, the department pushing ahead with its program or its plan to complete the year.
Okay, man. There's okay, man. Let me just come in there, man. There's so many things to unpack there. Let me just finish off the point with the school kids. So I can understand this erratic behavior and the anxiety, and I'm sure the stress level is also high. So from this working class background, because I'm also from a working class background. There's no protection for you there. So, do you think that this thing do you think it's going to have other form of social side effects, you know, given that there's not a lot of, because you know, you also can't play sport. So that type of volatile energy, man. Hello? Paul? Can you hear me?
Sorry, I lost you there for a moment.
Yeah, man, this thing just went off now.
I can hear you now.
Yeah, sure, man. Anyway, this thing just slammed off here. So yeah, man, like this energy that this is full of anxiety, that is full of fear. I'm sure that's also, and you know, given that they've got pretty much no social structures, not inside of the family, talking like in the neighborhood. What do you think that energy is going to manifest itself as, man? Because I mean, I can't see how can these kids concentrate fully, given that most of their houses are going to be full with people, and some of the parents are working at home as well. So, you know, given your experience, how do you think that, or where do you think that energy will manifest itself into?
Well, it depends on you know, how families cope with what's coming their way. how the communities cope with what's coming their way. And we know that what's going to be happening soon and what's happening already is the high job cuts
that's
coming. And, you know, if you go to job cuts, we also not only are dealing with job cuts, we're also having obviously a situation where people's salaries have been cut considerably.
Yeah.
Well, even teachers. I mean, you know, I know because I'm one of them, you know, your salary gets cut by like 50% or more. Yes. Some governing body post teachers haven't been paid even, as a matter of fact. Some have lost their jobs completely.
Yeah.
So there's a huge rupture now that's happening. And what's going to happen is that we can be expecting a high unemployment to be coming our way in the next period. And with that, a huge, we know the knock-on effects of that within our, within our communities.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, crime goes up, you know, there's a big issue around drugs. We lose contact with our youth. You know, we have all kinds of what they call social kind of issues happening with kids, obviously, you know, some of them may fall, women, girls falling pregnant, and so forth, and abuse, of course, within our community, in communities. So we have to be there to try and see where we can support communities, you know. I don't want to sketch a bleak picture. I think that, you know, the issue on the ground is one that's going to rupture, you know, our social kind of conditions on the ground in more than one way. We'll be almost, you know, predictable on the one hand, but the real depth and how widespread it's going to become is uncertain. So, I mean, it's going to be more important for activists and that on the ground to see how they can come together and work together to try and see what we can salvage in the situation we're in at the moment. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to just throw our hands up in despair. So it is a moment for us to step forward as well. You know, and I think a lot of our activists are caught behind social media and things like that, and caught behind you know, the screen. But they're not out there on the ground a lot of the time. Now, I know it's a difficult period that we're in at the moment. There's a virus and so forth.
Yeah.
But, you know, in periods of repression in the apartheid years, let me go back a few steps.
Yeah, we had please do.
Heavy repression. We had people killed, arrested, you know, detained. There was a whole, you know, kind of gamut of repressive machinery that they used to employ against us.
The virus
is here. We have to work with the virus. We have to get out there. We have to be cautious. We obviously have to be well aware of what we're doing. But we've got to also get out there in some way or the other. So, you know, I think that is a thing that we need to get beyond at this point. We need to get beyond the fear, beyond the anxiety.
That's actually where I want to come in on that. How does activists respond to this? Because coming from your position, you know, from the 80s, 70s, early 90s, as a bit of an activist myself, man, I know that the whole those fear has changed. And you are correct there when you say that the Muslim are hiding behind social media, because you have this pseudo sort of activism where through clicks and through likes, you know, there's this perceived like you're making some form of change. In some way, to a degree, it's probably correct, but we all know that doesn't work. So given that activism, and let me just go even a bit further. When you say we were talking about this sort of where this children's energy is going, that bleak picture, I agree with you when you're saying there that now there's time for innovation. And it's time for activists. I think there's a hell of an opportunity. And I kind of want to touch on technology, but maybe not right now. So I agree with you there fully. So when you say on this organization that you were, what was that organization with all the unions and what was the name again?
Progressive organization.
Yeah. So how are they re-looking at their strategy? What's their plans, man? Or what other ideas do you have going forward?
But the idea is to obviously to organize teachers and students along with parents. There are quite a few organizations within the formation made up of parent bodies as well as teacher bodies, even though our teachers are not really present. Okay. But I'm, for instance, part of the National Union of Public Servants and Allied Workers, the education sector. You know, we represent teachers within NUPSO as well as non-teaching staff.
Okay.
We have, for instance, COSATU Western Cape in the formation, as well as SATU. There's ANC elements in there. There's Unity Movement elements in there as well. And there are community organizations too, you know. So there's a whole mixture of people there, and they have their own social bases, in a sense. You know, they've got their own constituencies.
Yeah.
So the idea is to try and bring some of those together to form a formidable sort of front against what's happening in education at the moment. As you know, in education, our schools have been hard hit by the pandemic. The inequalities are stark. I mentioned some of it earlier in terms of our loss of teachers, students as well along the way. You know, there's great, as you were saying, fear, there's anxiety, and so we've got to try and deal with this, and we can't deal with it sitting in our homes. We actually have to come together in a physical way to do it, with using technology as well. The technology is an important part of the mobilization. And I want to say that when we talk of mobilization, it's not just mobilization in terms of people taking to the streets and, you know, marching and things like that, but mobilization in terms of how we support each other on the ground, how we, you know, create structures, you know, street committees, you know, community organizations, nutrition schemes to support people. You know, reading clubs. You know, education is not just what happens in schools.
Yeah.
You know, there's art. There's potential for art making here that goes beyond the possibilities. You know.
Yeah. Let me just actually come in there. I actually think that a way for these for the youth to sort of unleash that energy. Art is the most ideal platform because there's no form of competition. Because unlike sport. You know, I support and I watch, I consume a lot of sports. So I'm not dissing the whole thing, but like with sport, that thing of competitiveness, you know, there's always a winner and a loser. And I think right now, I don't think society needs that, you know. So I know, like in terms of writing, singing, even dancing, those type of mediums, I think they need it now more than ever. And on my side as a creative, because of all the other creators that I know are also sort of reapplying their talent or re-looking at the talent to see how it can fit these various needs, because the needs now are many. And I just want to raise another point, man, because I would love to, this is my dream as well, just to connect everybody, you know, in sort of one group organization or whatever. I don't even know what you want to call it, but as long as it's everyone is connected and sort of working together. So I definitely think that arts has got a role to play there, and I think creators should also take a step up. I wanna ask a sort of a I don't know if it's a controversial question, because but like you were saying, of all these members part of this collective, I don't hear anybody from the DA. Is there a reason for that?
Yes, the DA are in the Western Cape Education Department. there we go, you know. They've been protests outside the WCD offices. And in a sense, the WCD is representative to large, of the DA, governing party in the Western Cape. You know, the DA wants to obviously make sure that the schools are open before the national even declares schools must be open. It's almost as if we're dealing with a country on its own here.
Yeah, man. You know, let me actually come in there. I sort of pushed the agenda, Bichi, man. On social media this week, actually, there was a meme going around that, and I don't know if it's true, that the Western Cape was trying to develop their own flag. Is there any truth in that? Because they really want to, they really go across versus their own country. But like really pushing their own flag, I think is, and that flag looked very similar to the U.S. Confederate flag. So, but I can't validate is there if there's any truth in that. I shared it with a friend of mine in Cape Town, and he just brushed it off. That doesn't look very good. Can you still hear me? And I just hope that Paul can still stick around. Paul,
yeah,
are you still there?
I'm here.
Yeah, man. I was trying to push you to tell me some stuff about the DA because let me rather not slander just in case a potential funder is listening to my show. Yeah, I don't want to bite the hand that feeds me, but I've been reading and seeing some crazy shit coming from there. And there's certain individuals there too that I know that X-Collective also attacked very viciously and quite beautifully, actually, aesthetically. And I just think as a work of art, it's just beautiful. Never mind that the message is pretty hardcore. Because in Gauteng, it's bad, man. It's bad. And here in the Northern Cape, where my parents are, the MEC of Education actually died this week. They actually buried him. So I'm not sure. There's a lot of tears there. Not that I'm wishing ill on the dead. But anyway, man, let me leave this morbid DA thingy. Just moving forward, man. My understanding is that the way the school calendar is set up now that there's only one examination, how do you think this is going to impact so all the other grades that still have to, you know, finish their curriculum, finish their the grades and go forward and such? How do you think this is going to impact school in, you know, schooling in a long term, for example 2021, 2022 and so forth? And do you think that this thing, just like the 76 riots radicalized an entire generation of youth, do you think that this pandemic will radicalize the youth in 2020? And it's a sort of a three-part question, because coming from an activist background, do you want to play a role in that?
Yes, well, it's a difficult question to answer. From what I've gathered thus far in this short period, being exposed to what's happening on the ground.
Yeah.
People spoke about this being a moment when we must look at the possibilities of transformation.
Yeah.
That, like the Arundhati Roy idea that the pandemic is a portal, the portal to an alternative world.
That we don't have to
carry this the baggage of the past, the inequalities, the poverty, the unemployment with us through this portal, and that there's possibilities and there's hope ahead in this period, stemming from this period. Well, it's strange because actually what we do see happening, rather from what I can gather, is people trying to scramble back to the norm. much as possible, we're going to level two soon. That just shows that we're trying to normalize what went before and under conditions that are worse than we've been before.
Yeah.
So to answer that question that you pose about the possibilities of next year with students being radicalized, I've come to a partial conclusion that what you couldn't build in a period where you had more possibilities, where it was, as it were, where there was no virus. If you couldn't build in that period, it's very difficult to build in this period.
That's a good point.
Because the virus is keeping people away from each other. Though we talk of, against the idea of social distancing, we talk of physical distancing instead. Because, we're social, we still want to engage with each other, we want to organize. So we don't want to be using the term social distance. Mm-mm. We want to use the word rather physical distance. So I've noticed, obviously, on social media, people can communicate. They can connect with each other on that level. In ways, in very innovative ways. And that's very encouraging and that's very good, actually. But then to translate that into actual physical mobilization, where people now can take it a step further. There is, I think, over a period of time, the possibility that the virus, in a sense, will become part of what people experience on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And so people will start, I suppose, as it were, living with the, you know, start living with the virus in a more symbiotic way, in a way that, you know, they can actually maybe manage it or control it. And then that may open up possibilities. I mean, I've seen this in our formation at the moment, though, of course, it varies. Sometimes people attend, other times they're not. It's almost like what happens in our schooling environment at the moment. But over a period of time, we may be able to get to a point where we are able to meet and we are able to organize, to work with each other, and to protest together.
I think that's very important.
The Black Lives Matter mobilization and activism that happened in the United States is maybe a good reference at this point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
People could take to the streets, people could engage, people can be innovative in the public realm or domain. But we need time to get there. You know, we need to, in a sense, work with each other, protect each other, take care of each other. And I think the if we can do that and use the virus as a way, as a means in to link with other people, then I think we may actually build a stronger movement in that way. You know, so I think there is a great possibility there in the future, but it might take a bit of time. You know, struggle doesn't happen overnight. It takes time for it to be built and for organizations to be built. It's easy to break down organizations.
Yeah.
It takes a long time to build them.
Yeah, you know, I totally agree.
So I think there's a lot of possibility there going forward, Wesley.
Yeah, man, I just want to come in there with the going forward part, man. Like, I totally agree that, or rather, let me just give you a bit of a background. Like, I had an episode where we spoke about the Black Lives Matter with some friends and comrades of mine of that side of the world, and they raised the point, like, one of the reasons why I found this really interesting, that Black Lives Matter spread as quickly as it did, because, I mean, Black lives, I mean, Black bodies have been butchered by the police and governments across the world all the time. I mean, it's nothing new. But the reason why it happened now, well, what we came up with is that because of the pandemic, because there was all the news was shut, there was no sport, there was no entertainment, you know, there was just news. So when this thing broke, you know, everybody, because there was nothing else to consume. So it was easy for people to be bombarded with these images and the politics around it. And it obviously reverberated with everybody. And it grew. And I think that's, if you look at that as a sort of example with in terms of activism, because this thing that these school kids are feeling, and parents, I mean, every parent across, what, we're over 60 million people in the country, so I'm sure like a huge percentage of that is feeling exactly what we are talking about right now. So now, you know, in terms of innovative leadership, it's definitely the time right now to sort of mobilize. And, you know, coming from a bit of a younger generation, you know, I think the social media sphere is definitely the quickest way to get hold of everybody. Might not always be the most effective, but it's definitely, especially in terms of relaying messages and ideologies and so forth. And I definitely see some form of, I guess what everyone is trying to figure out is what we do, you know, because we can't forecast, you know, given like what's happened just now in New Zealand, you know, they were free for about 100 and so days, and all of a sudden there's 40 new cases. So, you know, it's that uncertainty that's giving me a hell of a lot of anxiety, I'll tell you that. And others too, man. So these times that we're living in is so crazy, man. That's why I feel it's very important to talk to people on the ground who's dealing with it, you know. I'm not trying to come up with an idea right now, but I think just the more we talk and the more we share, you know, ideas, you know, they just go into this creative heaven, and sometimes they work, you know. Because I definitely think that the arts, more than anybody else, should play a meaningful role here. Thus making art just for myself and just to make my, you know, I think that time is retired. I think artists should retire that. I know that's a lot easier said than done, but it exists, and that space, I definitely think that artists should should take care of that, man. So sort of in closing, man, let me just bring it back to yourself. You know, how are you taking care of yourself during COVID? I mean, given that you're an educator, you have the stress of dealing with multiple people, you know, are you, you know, how are you taking care of yourself?
Well, it's, you know, one has just got to be cautious, be mindful of the spaces you're operating in. When you're in a classroom, just try and be very alert to what's happening, how children are working in the room. You know, in art, it's always difficult. You know, art room, it's difficult because we tend to share things.
Yeah.
You know? Touching paper, we're touching paint brushes, and so initially I tried to actually separate everything out, eating plastic packets for each of the kids, books, brushes, containers, your space is over there and yours is there, and you know, okay. try and keep the physical distancing, but you know, I'm also a person, you know, I like to work with students in a more congenial way. You know, you want to interact with them. So if you show fear, I mean, you're just going to pass it on to them.
That's very clear, yeah.
So you've got to tell them you have to be cautious, but you know, you've got to sanitize as much as possible. And I must say the school has been very supportive in that sense.
Okay, they've
brought in the sanitizers and you know, we must just make sure that we use it often enough. And if the students come in, they aware of what can happen. You know, now of course there's an argument that children are not spreaders of the virus. They don't transmit the virus so easily. But of course there's some more recent evidence that shows that to the contrary, you know, so the verdict is out. And children are aware of some of this. And you know, in the anxious state, they nonetheless, I always tell them, rather on the side of caution.
Yeah.
You know, don't now think that you're not going to infect the next person and it doesn't spread and you will survive. It's not about you, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's about a whole range of other people, you know, your parents, your grandparents, and so on. And that they must be aware that, you know, when they're traveling to school, they already have compromised their physical distancing, you know. The whole thing about physical distancing in a school is partly a charade. Because they've already, you know, they've already come together. And so, yeah, you know, you've just got to be mindful of that kind of thing. And so when they take work home with them, you know, they must make sure they send it, they're careful about the work. They mustn't try and just let it lie around, you know, and they must speak to their parents about it and see how they can deal with working at home. Because they can't do all the work at school. There's not enough time at school for them to do that. So in this period, you know, one is trying to be just vigilant in terms of where work goes, how materials are used, you know, who's using common materials and where they can work on their own. So it's that type of organizing that has to happen inside the classroom. And then just be as relaxed about it as possible. You know, we've got to also look at the virus. We're aware of it, we're alert to it, but it mustn't be something that we're so fearful of, we don't know, you know, what to do from one
I see your point.
To the next.
I see your point.
You know, so in that way, I think, you know, I've been trying to cope with it. I obviously don't interact with much of my family at the moment because they're older than me. And I'm respectful of their concerns.
Yes.
But you know, when I go to meetings and that, you know, we obviously do apply physical distancing.
Yes.
And we wear the mask because we have to be respectful of each other.
Yes.
And the point is that the virus is dangerous. You know.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, we're mobilizing against the virus, and so it's pointless us saying now, you know, we're not going to wear masks or, you know, we can be relaxed and let our guards down. Because that defeats our very reason for mobilizing in the first place, you know. So it's that type of thing, you know.
I
so it's bringing the personal and the political and, you know, all those cultural practices together. And I just want to add on just as the last point.
Yeah, yeah, please.
You know, in our political formations, politics can keep us apart. But it's actually through a cultural movement that we've shown, through the Black Consciousness Movement in particular in the past of the 1970s,
yes,
that we can actually bring people together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Politics can separate us a lot. Our own politics within the liberation movement has kept us apart. But through a cultural movement, we can actually bring people together. And I think the arts plays a huge part in that.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. I couldn't have said it actually any better. No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, man. I would like to, you know, I'd like to, one of the part of the reasons of the podcast is also, you know, to talk to many creators, but also inspire ideas like that, man. I just hope everyone is, that people can tune in, man. And then like, we need that, man. Like we need that now more than ever. Yeah, man. Paul Hendricks, man, that was fantastic talking to you, my brother. Thank you very, very, very much. Sure. Thanks for the time. The insight into that is crazy, man. Like, yes, like it, man. And looking forward, you know, as much as we don't want to be pessimists, it's, you know, that it's not looking fresh, and government is not playing ball either. So, but, you know, I like to believe, you know, as Africans, we tough people, man. You can't live here and be weak. So we just got to man up and just move forward. But my brother, thanks a lot for everything, man. The episode will go live. And it's available on multiple platforms. So that's Spotify, Google apps, Google Podcasts, what's the other one? The iTunes and my our various websites too. So it'll get a lot of airplay. And I've noticed people always go back. So you know, that'll be very interesting. I'll definitely share the stats with you and the feedback that I get from everybody. Yeah, man, it'll be really cool also to touch base, let's say in a few weeks, months time, closer to the end of the year, because as a, you know, part of the podcast, I want to cover the education sort of process. Given like what, November's only a few weeks away now. I mean, yes, like it, man, I can't these kids is, the anxiety and the stress. A friend of mine, just in closing, man, a friend of mine was telling me early on today that, like, you know, because his kid is doing all his things through his laptop, and like, you know, he has four lessons a day, so each lesson is about a gig of data. So you add that up times, you know, five times, it's a lot of money. And our networks is nonsense, just to make it worse. So there's that pressure too, man. And I think that's also going to change people's perception and behavior towards technology, given that we were always taught to fear technology, which is something else that I've been touching base with here and there, but I'll cover in depth in the future, because I think we want to own that space, man. But anyway, my brother, this was fantastic, man. Thank you a lot, man.
Sure. Thank you, Wesley. A better world is possible. An alternative world is possible. You know, we have built it now.
Absolutely.
Virus or no virus.